Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. And the next 2 hours are going to fly right by, I promise, because we've got This Week in Law coming up with Dave Levine, Michael Frumkin, Mike Keyes, and me. We're going to talk about Burr Feinstein, the DTSA, lots and lots of robots, your animal selfie of the week, and much more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Mike Keyes, episode 343, recorded April 22nd, 2016. Moral Crumple Zones. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/TWiL. Hello, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I am so glad this week. I'm so blessed and fortunate. We are so blessed and fortunate here at This Week in Law that we have a two-hour time slot for our show. And this is one of those weeks where I just could not be more grateful for it. Where else do you get a two-hour time slot to talk about everything that's fascinating and important at the intersection of technology and law? And I find that we really need that time to go deep on these issues with the really, really brilliant people that deign to come on the show. And this week is a prime example of how we're actually going to have to rush and scramble to get through everything we want to talk about in 2 hours. And that's because we have just a really stellar panel joining us today. Two of our favorite law professors in the United States have returned to the show. Dave Levine, who's a professor at Elon University School of Law in Greenville, North Carolina. He's an affiliate scholar at Stanford's Center for the Internet and Society and the host of Hearsay Culture, one of my favorite other shows on technology, policy, and law. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Denise, and thanks for having me back on. And the feelings are mutual. I listen in whenever I can and watch when I can, so I'm excited to be back.
It's wonderful to have you back. Also returning to the show is Michael Frumkin, who's a professor at University of Miami School of Law and the chair of the annual We Robot Conference, which just happened. He writes at discourse.net, and we're so thrilled to have you back, Michael.
It's my pleasure.
Also joining us is my co-host, Mike Keyes. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be with you, as always, and great to have quite a star-studded cast with us today as well.
I know, right? Mike is a partner at Dorsey in Seattle and in Palo Alto, and he contributes to Dorsey's great blog, which is called The TMCA. That's probably not their only blog, but it's the one on trademark, copyright, and advertising, which is what TMCA stands for. So wonderful to see you again this week, Mike.
Likewise.
All right, let's get right into it. We Robot just happened on the 1st and 2nd of April, so we're going to talk about some robot law. Michael, how many years of We Robot has it been now?
This was our fifth one already. It's incredible.
That is incredible.
And next year, we'll be
here. Victor, I'm getting some weird feedback. Are you getting that too? Nope, I think it's gone now. Good. Okay. So we'll soldier on. So 5 years of We Robot. Can you tell us, having chaired all of these, Michael?
No, I only chaired the ones in Miami, so just three of them.
Oh. Okay, so but that's about three of them?
Yes. The other two on the West Coast so far.
Got it. But you've attended all of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've been on the program committee every year. But thank God I don't have to chair at all.
Yes, I can imagine. Give us your take now, having been intimately involved in five of these, as to where things stand and how they're developing.
Well, when we started, it was kind of like a Woodstock moment, finding all these people from different fields who suddenly discovered that there were people who shared a set of common interests. So that was sort of the beginning of it. And mm-hmm. now it's exploded. Right? 5 years later, there's so many more people building robots, investing in robots, thinking about regulating robots. Right, the Google car is now in public consciousness, so a lot of people want to regulate robots. It's just gigantic. That's one change. A second change is the conference, at least, has really gone international. Right? I mean, our first conference, you know, the international dimension was Canadians. Now it's global. It's really global. And that's been a very different cast on the conversations when you have people from Europe who have a quite different approach to regulation, or at least where they start from, I guess, maybe not where they end up. We have people from the Asia-Pacific region, South America, a Caribbean lawyer. So it was a very different conversation, not just the accents, also the substance.
Right. And bearing that in mind, given that at least here in the U.S., at the federal level, there's nothing to speak of in the way of regulation that would begin. Well, I was about to say that would begin to cover where robotics is going.
There's actually there's more than you think. I mean, think about it, right? You've got NHTSA, which is already making statements about whether a robotic car counts as having a driver. Mm-hmm. You've got the Federal Aviation Administration, you know, just turning out tons of regulations about drones.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, you know, the DARPA challenges, of course. That's not regulation, but very stimulating to robot technology. You've got the whole President's Robotic Initiative. You've got tons of stuff in the healthcare sector where people are worrying about robots from everything as pill dispensers. You've got some privacy issues. I think there's quite a lot happening at the federal level. And the thing that makes it very different from the other tech area where I've been very involved, which is the internet, is you've also mm-hmm. got a lot of people involved at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think cars, right? Every DMV wants to be at the table.
Right, and probably, do you think every DMV should be at the table?
Well, they've got jurisdiction over their roads, right? I mean, they have a right. You know, so probably, you know, as long as we're staying federal structure, yes.
Yeah.
Can I jump in on that?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Please jump in.
Yeah, I was just saying, and I'm a big, I have not attended WeRobot, and that's my loss. I was actually at the conference that was happening at the same time, the Black Box conference at Yale ISP that Frank Pasquale was doing. One of the challenges there, I think, is, and I'm curious about Mike's take on this, is the capacity of state-level DMVs to deal with the technological complexity of fully autonomous vehicles, which seems to be a massive problem. And at least Google has taken the position in some filings that the DMV literally may not have the capacity to really understand the data that's shared with it, which I think is a really interesting question of capacity and technological expertise and policymaking.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, the DMVs are not as clued up in all kinds of ways as the feds have been. And it's not clear how fast that can change because, you know, resource constraints. But it's also the case always that whenever you have a company that wants to push a product that's going to be subject to potentially inconsistent rules across jurisdictions, they always want to federalize it. So you have to be a little careful. The other thing I would point out to you is that the DMVs, for all their faults, and they've got faults. I mean, anybody who's stood in line, the DMV knows they've got faults. They're pretty good at standardizing on a national level, right? I mean, you can drive your car from one side of the country to the other. You don't have to get off at the state line and change the, you know, the license plate, the headlights, you know, put in a new transponder, anything like that. So they do understand that this is a single country. The much more complex question, actually, is how you internationalize this. Because taking a robot car across a national border, that's a whole new order of complexity.
Right, and that's what I was circling around to in saying that, at least on the AI front, I think we're still at a point where federal regulators and lawmakers haven't quite decided to go there. At least here in the U.S. And I'm wondering if you think that we'll see more rulemaking on the international front than we do on the nation state front, or if you think those things will develop in tandem?
Well, now we have to have a philosophical discussion about what AI is. Mm-hmm. Because some people might say there isn't any yet, so there's no product shipping, so there's nothing to regulate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a very complicated question. I mean, so right now, the kind of AI that seems to be moving the fastest is Watson-like. It's not neural nets. It's Watson-like, right? So Watson is really a very, very good simulation of an AI rather than being an AI, as you know, science fiction thought about it. And so we're going to probably be regulating Watson, not as Watson, but applications of Watson. Right. So, for example, at the first robot conference 5 years ago, one of the papers talked about the problem, what happens when using a Watson diagnostic system to do healthcare. And what happens if the robot someday, it isn't yet, but becomes a better diagnostician than the doctor? Does that become the standard of care? Is it malpractice to use a doctor, not a robot at that point? And what do you do when they disagree? So those, you know, that'll be a medical regulation issue.
Right.
So we're not going to regulate Watson. We're going to regulate the use of Watson in medicine.
Yep. Excellent point. And I guess the fact that one of the Google self-driving cars just got in its first accident is a good entree to talk about those same kinds of concerns on the automotive front. That it's not
the Google car
was necessarily unsafe. It just got in an accident. All of the rest of us safe drivers get in an accident from time to time too.
So I feel for the robot car designers, because you can really imagine a world where there's only robot cars on the road and everybody's a lot safer than they are now. The dangerous thing is the transition. I mean, the two robot cars didn't run into each other. The robot car had a slight fender bender with a bus.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently I had it with the bus because it was maybe more cautious than the bus expected. So, you know, I think it's ridiculous to expect an accident-free world, at least as long as there's, excuse the term, legacy cars on the road. The question is, are we safer than we would be if that was a human driver? And I think it's very likely already the case, and certainly will be the case before those things get put on the road in any significant number.
Definitely.
So the accidents, you know, it's a moment in history, but it's actually not, I think, deeply significant. Accidents were inevitable. There'll be more accidents. And counting accidents is the wrong thing. You have to say compared to what.
Right. And compared to what becomes the key question is, you know, ultimately we're going to get to a point, as you were saying, in the medical context where perhaps the artificially intelligent device or mechanism is more safe than a human alternative. And what does that do to us?
Well, it means I got a safer way to send my kids to school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what do to us is a funny way. It enables us.
Mm-hmm. It definitely, from the law and policy standpoint, it's going to involve some creative thinking, though.
A lot of hard work in making pieces fit together. But, I mean, the robot car is, in some ways, probably an easier problem conceptually than the robot doctor, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, the robot car is maybe a tougher problem to implement because there are more players. But conceptually, there are a couple thorny liability questions we have to decide. Right? Who's going to be ultimately responsible when something goes wrong? And I suspect for both legal and marketing reasons, in the short run, we're going to have the manufacturers step up and volunteer to be liable, probably because they would be anyway. So why not get good PR for volunteering? And that's probably a good decision because they can get cheaper insurance at a fleet level than we can get individually. And also they have all the relevant information about safety and the control over how to make it safer. The tough case that worries me a little bit is the hybrid case again, right? So supposing you have a robot car, but you have a possibility for a human override. And imagine the car saying, oh, danger, you know, warning Will Robinson, something terrible is going to happen. And the human being starts to take control of the car. Now, are we going to suddenly say that the human being's taken on all the liability when they got put into a bad situation and maybe didn't get out of it very well?
Mm-hmm.
that would be a problem. We had a great paper about that at the conference, actually, which talked about human beings as moral crumple zones. So that is a word.
Moral crumple zones. I like it. I also really like the way that you pointed out that even if we don't have laws that are, that were when they were written, designed to deal with whatever form of artificial intelligence that we do have or don't have, or other automated systems that might not qualify as AI, that they're going to struggle along and regulate whatever we've got in the meantime until there's something directly on point. And we're going to have this long period of time between the car or the doctor or whatever other field you want to slot in here. Between now, when things are clunky and as they're getting better and better, and then as they're getting to the point where they might actually be safer or so much better than humans that you would go with that standard. So it's going to be a really strange growth period. And I think in the middle of all that, it's a good time to talk about Tay. Who's a good example of, you pointed us to an article for the show today that's titled Why Robots Need to Be Able to Say No. Poor Tay needed to be able to say no. Can you expand on that for us?
So the article I pointed to is about situations that, you know, robots, for example, are being used a lot or trialed a lot for things like elder care. It's mm-hmm. one of the issues in the elder care is you want the patient who may not be 100% control their faculties at all time. You want them to take their meds on time. So what do you do if the patient who's just maybe had medicine the last hour is supposed to take it every 6 hours, forgets they've had it, and demands another pill? Right? The robot's got to be able to say, no, I can't give you when you just had it. So now we've got, you know, so much for Asimov's three laws, right? Well, I suppose you say you're protecting the human from harm, so maybe Asimov's still doing okay. But there are lots of other situations where robots ought to be designed in a way that they won't agree to do dangerous things when they're told to. And the trouble with that, of course, is nothing's ever perfect. And that means sometimes there may be a really good reason why they should do the dangerous thing, which you didn't think about when you wrote the program, and the robot will still say no. And that's going to be a bad outcome. And in general, just, you know, enabling no changes the power relationship between the robot and the person. Right? Now the person's not completely in charge. In the case of the elder care robot, maybe some third party's more in charge. But then so the robots become a force multiplier for control over the person who's been given the robot. So these are all quite serious problems. Tay, I don't know if it's exactly. I mean, Tay was just bad programming, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, it wasn't so much saying no as picking the wrong things to learn from.
Right.
We don't know, you know, we don't know that much about how complicated the program was. It's part of the trouble.
Can I jump in on that one too?
Please.
The fact that Tay was launched, from what we can tell, without much in the way of filtering, so that within 24 hours it was spewing all kinds of bile, part of which was apparently coming from the programming itself, and part of it was coming from the fact that it was apparently programmed to repeat at some level whatever it is that it was told to say, kind of raises this, I think, a broad issue that those in the robotics community and the AI community are going to have to grapple with, which is how much the public ultimately needs to know about the programming so that we avoid socially undesirable outcomes, which, again, to put it mildly, the stuff that Tay was saying as it got taken over, as it were, by Twitter was doing. And it's unclear to me how much of what Google and Microsoft and others have done in other contexts, which I know we might talk about later with regard to transparency, you know, whether it be Google's willingness to share some information about how many requests that it gets under the European right to be forgotten, or whether its transparency with regard to takedown notices and the like is going to translate to the kinds of really fundamental questions that we have about robotics and AI, particularly as we know, these are new technologies that really have not been introduced in a lot of ways, in meaningful ways, to the general public. I mean, as Mike pointed out earlier, right, if we're at a Watson level of AI, the capabilities are potentially greater. And so I think what I'm saying is that Google and other robotics entities really, I think, have to think very carefully and I think relatively quickly about how much they desire to share with the public before narratives about robotics and AI become unnecessarily catastrophic or negative. I think they run a real risk of losing control of the narrative and of the stories around these technologies by, you know, what are at one level are humorous, but in other levels are really disturbing, you know, outcomes with regard to Tay.
So let me be the devil's advocate here for a minute.
Yeah, please.
Supposing we were talking about the development of aircraft. Would you be saying, you know, people shouldn't be allowed to fly planes that could crash because it gives air travel a bad name? And if you think about the history of, you know, early flight, it's full of crashes. Right? All the pioneers, all the test pilots, they're crashing all the time. Right? I mean, I remember reading a biography of one of the early ones, and he broken practically every bone in his body during his lifetime. Now, they weren't putting passengers in there. But, you know, Tay wasn't being a ship product either.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in terms of giving things a bad name, I'm not convinced. I think, you know, the public will be able to evaluate version 3.0 on its own. I mean, remember, you probably used Windows back before 3.1. And it got over it, right? I mean, at some point, I mean, some of us, you know, didn't forgive it until, you know, Windows 7. But even, you know, even then we forgave it.
No, I'm sorry, Mike. Go ahead, yeah.
I guess the other thing I was going to say is I know you've just been to a conference on algorithmic transparency, and we do need to talk about that. It's a very important idea. But it's hard to imagine we're ever going to get to the point where we're going to make Google tell us how it calculates Google rank. That's like their trade secret.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so on the first point, yeah, I mean, and I think there's a risk associated with and there's no question. I mean, Mike, I'm definitely a fan of transparency, although I'm not a radical transparency person like Julian Assange. In other words, there's plenty of information should be kept secret. I'm not suggesting that the technology is bad and that we should therefore not introduce technology or view it as a net negative. I guess what I'm trying to make clear or to point out is that with regard to the introduction of new technologies, the assumption I think made by many on the manufacturing and innovation side is that there is a general understanding of what the technology is or isn't. And so when you've got behaviors like Tay's, right, it plays into a narrative that I think, again, I mean, I'm saying this because I'd like to see the technology rolled out in a thoughtful way. You run the risk of having the technology labeled. You know, you see the same kinds of issues come up with other new technologies. I've been very involved in dealing with questions involving how hydraulic fracturing or fracking is rolled out in states, and in where I live in North Carolina, which is doing all kinds of, I think, bad things at this point at the state level. But putting those issues aside, there was a very interesting debate a few years ago about that very issue of trade secrets around fracking. And one of the interesting points that came up was including the commissioner of the Mining and Energy Commission, Jim Womack. He made the point that if we label things as trade secrets, like the chemical composition of what's going in the ground, it's going to get the fracking opponents the opportunity to tell the story. That, I think, is something that should be taken seriously. With regard to the trade secret point, yes. I mean, clearly, if Google was forced to share its formula for coming up with rankings, that is unquestionably a trade secret, and that would unquestionably be damaging to the economic interests of Google. On the other hand, Google being the primary intermediary of information on the internet, in my view, does have, because of that responsibility, a greater need to be more clear about what, for example, its search algorithm does, how its search algorithm works. Again, that doesn't mean that they have to put the code out there and therefore allow all of these SEOs SEOs or search engine optimizers to have an even more lucrative business. But I think it's a fair question to raise again in the case of Google's trade secrets there, given its power to control what we know. So my point is that, yes, I have come from a conference on algorithmic transparency, although I've been writing about these issues for in one way or another involving code for about 10 years. But I do think that I am concerned that there could be one story that's told about technology which would have the simultaneous negative impacts of not allowing the technology to roll out thoughtfully, but worse, kind of criminalizing or tainting technologies much the way that the internet was tainted with regard to copyright infringement as merely a tool of infringement rather than as a tool of sharing knowledge. I don't want to see robotics and AI suffer a similar fate.
It really held the internet back, didn't it?
Well, but the flip side is that a lot of the behaviors that we now view as socially beneficial were labeled initially as criminal. Lessig wrote about that heavily, the criminalization of production. So again, the internet itself obviously has been successful, but there have been behaviors and activities on the internet that have been criminalized and perhaps shouldn't have, and vice versa.
I don't know. I look at my kids and they don't seem to have any respect for copyright at all. Yeah. So I don't know how effective that was.
But I mean, at some level, they have no choice, right? Because there's been so many measures put into place that prevent them from being able to share and copy files the way that back in the day you were able to.
Yeah, it takes an extra day before somebody cracks it.
Yeah, I guess it just gives them a challenge. Let's talk about the talk that you gave at Yale, Dave, on confidentiality creep. What did that involve?
So along the lines of, in part of what I've just been talking about, I've been concerned over the last multiple years at this point about the increasingly amorphous claims to secrecy and even privacy increasingly that are really untethered from any previously existing basis for keeping information secret. Let me give you an example of what I'm thinking about and then translate it to what's going on here and what Mike and I are talking about. So again, it pains me to say it because I'm a citizen of North Carolina, but North Carolina about 6 months ago now passed a law that makes it impossible for the public to find out the names of chemical manufacturers used to administer the death penalty. And the stated reason why this information is not public is not trade secret. It's not privacy. What it is, and this was the stated reason, was it would be difficult for the chemical manufacturers to deal with protesters. That is not a recognized interest from a theoretical standpoint or practical standpoint that exists for keeping information from the public, particularly regarding something like the administer of death by state. And increasingly, I'm seeing that there's very broad strokes being leveled across the board in trade secrecy, in confidentiality, increasingly in privacy, which simply says this information is private or should be kept from the public without really explaining why. And ultimately, I think it can lead to deleterious impacts. So the confidentiality creep concept that I've coined is this increasing amorphous statement that the public can't know X, Y, and Z without really giving an explanation that's grounded in law. Simultaneously, we have information like what Mike and I have been talking about or involving drones or involving any other new technologies where the information itself has both public and private interest. So it has a private interest because a company would like to keep information secret because it's a trade secret, or because in the case of military technologies, we need to keep it secret because our enemies could find exploits. But it also has a public aspect to it in the sense that the public may want to know what's going on. We may want to allow experts who are not affiliated with governments to offer input to make better policy. And so how do we deal with the simultaneous problem of confidentiality creep and amorphous claims of secrecy on one side, but has information having what I'm calling a dual use nature, a dual use secrecy. And so the paper is designed to think through those problems and offer a theoretical basis for making the argument of of granularity in these discussions with some practical implications. It's a project I'm working on right now, which is why I was thrilled to be on today with Mike, because I respect his work as I respect his colleagues, Ryan Kahlo and Woody Hartzog and Margo Kaminsky and on all the folks who have made We Robot such a wonderful conference. And so that's kind of the dovetail. I'm working on it now. And so, if you care to have me on in the future, I think I'll have more concrete things to say about it. But I'm really trying to flag the issue now. And I'm flagging it, by the way, and I want to give this credit in part based upon the work that Frank Pasquale's done in his book Black Box Society, which I highly recommend, and really flagging these broad issues of corporate secrecy. Again, very importantly, it's not an argument that all information should be public. I'm a fan of IP and I'm a fan of secrecy properly used. I'm concerned that it is getting far beyond what we have previously seen with impacts that I think are largely negative.
So I wasn't able to find the paper, the link on that Denise provided, but I just want to ask you, it seems to me there's a big distinction, at least traditionally, between public secrecy and private secrecy. Mm-hmm. Right? So the North Carolina thing you started with is a really weird and disturbing kind of law because it's using public power to enforce a certain kind of private secrecy that for a bad cause. But normally, when we have firms, right, we sort of the default is they can keep stuff secret if they want to, and then we regulate them in one of two ways to force them to make disclosures. Right? Either we just say you got to make disclosures, you got to put the label on the cereal what's in there, or you got to tell the regulator what's your trade secrets about what's in the rodenticide, and we promise not to tell the public. We just need to know so we need to know if it's safe to use or not. That's one version, right? Disclosure rules. And the other version is market, antitrust laws, right? We force you to have competitors. If your competitors are more open, people will trust them more. So I wish I'd read the paper, but I would know. But it seemed to me that at least in your intro, you sort of conflated the public and the private pieces, which maybe I'm just too old-fashioned. They seem very different. And the private stuff in some way much scarier. The public stuff. Much scary, right? The public stuff is the bill you cited. It's secret courts. It's all kinds of terrible stuff.
No, and Mike, I want to be clear about this. The reason why you didn't read the paper, because I would not want you to in any way denigrate what you've done, because the paper doesn't exist yet. This is and for those outside the academic world, what you're seeing here and Mike and I is what happens at Works in Progress conferences. And I really appreciate Mike taking this on and pushing back, because this is what I think is great about your show, Denise and Mike, and what we should be doing. To answer your question quickly without turning this into pure an academic conference, which I'm not sure that Denise wants to stream, in a lengthy way.
I'm learning stuff.
Oh, that's good. So then I'll keep going a little bit and say that's a great point, Mike, and that's where I think the struggle is. The private interests here are not, although trade secrecy is a big part of it, right? Privacy plays a role as well. And so there's information that we simply don't need, we being the public, for purposes of accountability, for purposes of input, or really for purposes of even democracy, right? So do I need to know, for example, Harry Cerdan, who I know you know, who's been a We Robot as well, came to Elon earlier this week to present his paper that he's soon to be published, publishing on autonomous cars. Harry's paper, which is wonderful, pointed out, for example, that, as I know you know this, Mike, that apparently individuals at Google, the human beings, right, are in fact annotating the maps that are used by fully autonomous vehicles so that we can avoid the kinds of accidents and problems that have existed. Do I need to know as a member of the public that there's a human being doing that? No, I probably don't need to know that, right? Is there a really strong public interest in knowing that information? Well, I guess it's interesting, but in terms of accountability or transparency or input, probably not, right? To the extent, however, that, and now I'm hypothesizing, but to the extent, however, and this is not in Harry's paper, that Google is making normative decisions about the relative import of one particular hazard or marking on a map versus another, that we might want to know. Ryan Kahlo pointed out when that accident happened in February, I thought a fascinating point, which I've been thinking about a lot, which is that Google stated that its car had made, quote, an assumption, unquote. Well, you know, how does a car, right, coded, make an assumption? And so those are private interests in terms of, again, Google's ability to create new technologies. But on the flip side, right, if we want to avoid accidents, if we want, particularly since these are public roads, if we want the public to have more confidence, then there's a public aspect to it. Now, admittedly, the example I used from North Carolina is an extreme one, but it's not. It's increasingly common to see these kinds of amorphous, not entirely explained claims of secrecy. Trade secrecy, for example, is widely labeled and used by corporate interests, particularly submitting information to the government, and everything's a trade secret. Well, everything's not a trade secret, and to the extent that we can draw those lines in a more granular way, I think by drawing distinction between public and private, which I agree is different, although I'm not sure how much those terms mean these days, given how much the public and private interests interact, we should think it through. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm still thinking these through. That's a great question, and I'll be happy to I would love to share the paper with you.
I'll be happy to read it.
Thank you.
Let me say something about Harry Serdin, though, because you mentioned him. Yep. He gave a version of that paper, We Robot, and he made another interesting point, which ties together about three things we've talked about, but flips what you said about Ryan. Harry made the point. This was, I thought, brilliant. When you or I drive down the street, we are by necessity making assumptions about other drivers. They're going to stay in their lanes. They're not going to do crazy stuff. Well, in Miami, you're actually assuming they will do crazy stuff, but it's exceptional. But you know, you have a model of what other drivers might do. And that robot car got into the accident with the bus because apparently it didn't act like the way a person would. Yeah. Which raises the question, how will human drivers have a model of what robot drivers do? And that's right. A really good question. Yes. And that could algorithmic transparency may be one kind of answer to that. Although you don't really want to know the algorithm. You want to know how fast is the car going to go. Right. And you want to be sure you know which are the robot cars if they drive different from regular people.
You said before, Michael, that it's been argued that the car drove too cautiously and that's what caused the accident. Yeah, I know it was trying to avoid some sandbags.
They rush out into traffic in front of buses, real drivers, regular drivers. Uh-huh. Apparently the car went slowly into traffic and the bus clipped it.
Got it.
Yeah, and that kind of problem is one that – I'm sorry, Denise. I see you there. I don't want to step on anyone here.
No, you're not stepping on me. I wanted to understand – And I think that's a really interesting point that you raise, Michael, that human being drivers, and going back to the point I made earlier, that we're going to have this weird sort of development period before the technology actually gets to a point where we feel that it can trust it. We can trust it and it's ubiquitous, and we're going to have this time where people and automated systems are interacting with each other and trying to navigate that, and it's going to be
strange. Can I follow up on that? You raised another really important point there, which for me was probably the biggest takeaway of this conference we just had. Our first presentation was by an anthropologist it was the Moral Crumple Zone papers, who talked primarily about how things go wrong in other industries. She used examples from airplane crashes and from nuclear power plants going wrong from Three Mile Island. And it made me realize that I've been thinking about robots wrong for 4 years. I've been thinking about robots is about robots. But robot problems aren't about robots. They're about a system with a robot in it. Always.
Right. Right.
And
well,
that's
again,
a very different perspective.
Yes. And the unpredictability of human beings in that system is one that I think that people might not take into account enough. And that's what we saw with Tay. I don't know if we qualify Tay as a robot or a flawed piece of software or what have you, but the problem wasn't so much with Tay, who I'm sure worked fine when the Microsoft engineers were testing her out. But once you subjected her to the unpredictability of the wild world, everything went to heck. So
you need lawyers as beta testers.
Yes.
We'll think of something terrible.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about laws, lethal automated weapons systems for a moment, since there was just a meeting of experts on that topic? Michael, you put this in, so maybe you can just give us the takeaway for it.
This is awful depressing. We're still talking about the same issues we were really talking about 4 years ago with automated, with armed robots. And I mean, there is a growing, I mean, the cheerful part is there's a growing international movement to try to ban weaponizing robots. The uncheerful part is it's happening very quickly. The international agreement we might have, the easiest time to ban a new weapons technology is before anybody's deployed it, because they don't have any sunk costs. And they also don't have a belief that they might have an edge over somebody else. And that moment is getting away from us. That's a little scary. I mean, I actually think weaponizing robots is the worst single thing we can do in the robotic space. It's going to be bad if you worry every time you hear a drone flying overhead that it might have a taser or worse. That's a bad thing, both for drones and for enjoying your backyard. Right now the United States has an enormous advantage in weaponized drones, but that's a very temporary thing. It's a relatively inexpensive, accessible technology. So there are going to be lots of countries having those. And, you know, if you want to do terrorism, what better than an armed drone? So I think we're missing a really important boat here. And it's got me down.
Yeah, I saw the piece that you did with Celia Ample of the Daily Business Review after We Robot. And you mentioned in passing that there will be 7 million drones in the air by 2020. Does that include,
FAA estimate. I just took their number because, you know, they're they're authoritative. I assume that includes the little teeny ones and big ones. But that's just in the U.S. It's not worldwide even.
Does it include military ones, do you think?
I don't know, but presumably the number there isn't going to be so high as to move the needle a giant amount because they tend to be bigger. I mean, unless the military really manages to get those little tiny spy drones going, which, you know, have been on the drawing board forever.
Right.
Then we'll have, you know, but something mosquito size that follows you around all day. That'll be great.
Yes, it will. 7 million by 2020. That stopped me in my tracks there a bit. All right. Well, I'm going to stop the show in its tracks for a moment. We'll put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer or other professional who is listening or watching the show to get professional credit in your field. And some oversight bodies require you to be able to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened and did not just put down episode 343 of This Week in Law on a list somewhere. So our first phrase will be mosquito drones. And we'll put another one in at some point. We're also going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law before we get back into talking about some really interesting legislative and policy developments in just a moment here. We wouldn't be here at all without our sponsor, which this week is Braintree. That's code for easy mobile payments. Maybe you're working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub. Then why not use the same simple payment solution that helped them become what they are today? Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless, it's almost magical. Add it to your app with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. And if some other way to pay comes along, Braintree's going to support that too, gold darn it. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. See fewer abandoned carts and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To check it out for yourself, just visit BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's move on to some developments on the legislative side. All right, Dave, I know you are dying. You're literally jumping up and down in your seat to talk about the Defend Trade Secrets Act. So let's start with that. Please tell us what's going on.
Sure. So I have spent the better part of the last multiple months on and off, but certainly over the last 2 years, to be very clear, opposing the Defend Trade Secrets Act. What the Defend Trade Secrets Act is a federal an effort by Congress to create a private cause of action for trade secret misappropriation in federal law. What this means is, to be clear, that trade secret plaintiffs, so, you know, companies that are alleging that someone or took one of their secrets, right, that has value and misappropriated, is using it in some kind of anti-competitive way, can now go into federal court, in addition to state court, to bring a cause of action. The DTSA is a bill designed to open up the federal courts to these entities who have made, and these entities, to be clear, we're talking about large companies like DuPont and 3M and others who are involved in legislation. But really, it's anyone who has a allegation of trade secret misappropriation to avail themselves of federal courts. Very importantly, the DTSA also includes what's called an ex parte seizure provision, and what that allows is the trade secret plaintiff to go into court and on allegations of a threatened loss of value to the trade secret, seize the assets of a trade secret defendant. The ex parte part means that the defendant will not be there to defend itself. The DTSA, as far as its status, seems to be sailing along in Congress. It was passed 87-0 in the Senate a short while ago. It was marked up a few days ago in the House. And at this point, it looks like it very well may become law. Sharon Sandeen at Hamlin, Chris Seaman at Washington Lee, and another one of, I think, your favorite law professors, Denise, Eric Goldman at Santa Clara. The four of us have worked together to oppose the DTSA. Our concerns are many, but the broad strokes are, first, we simply don't think that the DTSA is needed. There is the evidence supporting the need for a federal private cause of action. It simply doesn't exist. And there's very little empirical data around trade secrecy to support the need for it. Eric, in particular, has highlighted the abusive potential for the ex parte seizure provision. And the way I think of it is, kind of, you think about the problems with the Stop Online Piracy Act from a few years ago. One of the big concerns was the ability to seize domain name addresses and therefore knock companies off the internet. Well, there's a similar potential risk here. And so we're concerned about that. And I've also been concerned about the ability potentially of the DTSA to actually weaken cybersecurity standards for corporate entities by encouraging litigation that could otherwise be.
He was going great, too.
He was, too.
Yeah, he was on a roll.
Yes. Well, let's get him back. And Mike Keyes, I know you had some thoughts on the DTSA. Is there anything you want to respond with to what Dave was just saying?
Yeah, so I did read Dave's very excellent article, Schoolboy's Tricks. And as he mentioned, he and some very distinguished professors in the academy have opposed the legislation. Seems like one of the big opposition points is what he was mentioning about the seizure order.
The person you know, as I read trying the to bill, reach is currently unavailable. Please leave a message.
Oh, sorry about that.
On?
Yeah,
no
go on, Mike.
So as I read the proposed legislation, though, that's passed the Senate, you know, these seizure orders, although it sounds very significant and very scary, seizure orders only issue upon a showing of extraordinary circumstances. And it's got to be clear to the court that there's going to be some significant damage immediately if there's not an ex parte order that issues. So in that sense, it seems to me that this alleged problematic aspect of the statute may be a little bit overstated. The other thing that seems to me to be significant in the proposed bill is that there is a provision that provides for a wrongly affected party to actually countersue and seek, among other things, punitive damages associated with a wrongful seizure. So you've got some built-ins into the statute that seem to me that adequately address problems like what Dave's mentioned. The other thing I should mention is that the provision in the bill that provides for a cause of action against a wrongfully seized party's assets, we have that exact same provision in the Lanham Act already. So it seems to me there's precedent for this type of seizure aspect in federal law. The other thing I like about the proposed legislation is, look, we've got a copyright statute that provides a exclusive jurisdiction in federal courts for copyright violations. We've got the Lanham Act that provides a protection in federal court for obviously trademark infringement and false advertising claims. We've got the patent statute that provides exclusive jurisdiction in federal court. What's so wrong with also federalizing a potential trade secret cause of action in federal court? It seems to me the courts are obviously very well equipped to deal with these types of issues. And again, I think the problem of a potential wrongful seizure is probably a little bit overblown.
Okay, well, if we get Dave back, I'm sure he'll have some rejoinders for you. The only rejoinder I have for you is just that it seems there's such a long history of and state body of law on trade secrets that to at this late juncture make that purely a creature of federal law and federal courts seems, I you know, again, I think you'd need to get the constitutional scholars to weigh in on that one and when it's appropriate to federalize something and when it's not. But here it seems like something that would be pretty far down the road of states acting in this area. Don't you agree?
Well, as I read and understand the proposed bill, it's not preempting state laws with respect to trade secret misappropriation or causes of action in state court. You can still bring a cause of action in state court for trade secret misappropriation. This just provides a federal venue potentially that you might not otherwise have if you didn't have a basis to be in federal court. So, for example, if there wasn't already diversity or if you didn't have a claim under the Lanham Act or copyright infringement, for example, you wouldn't be able to get into federal court if you're dealing with a non-diverse issue, meaning that you don't have diversity.
I've never taught trade secrets, but is that common? I mean, the thing that you know, this is really outside my wheelhouse, but my first question is, how broke is it? Does it need fixing? And the second is, the one thing that makes trade secrets really different from patent, copyright, trademark, is you don't have to go and do some official act to register its existence. So the first time you're ever going to have to claim its existence is when you go into court and demand somebody else's assets be seized, at which point it's going to be hard for them to get representation to fight back. I don't know. But, I mean, again, I haven't read the bill. On this, I got to defer to you guys.
Go ahead.
That kind of specter makes it sound like it could be worse than our patent situation right now. And Dave is back. So, Dave, we've been rattling on in your absence.
I appreciate that. And the irony, of course, of losing bandwidth during discussing trade secrets on a video podcast. Now, I think I caught a little bit of what was going on there. What this boils down to is when you look at the stated basis for having the bill in the first place, the initial argument was that foreign entities are stealing U.S. trade secrets, and therefore there's a need for more than the very robust state law that exists, that has existed at least in uniform manner for over 30 years. For some reason, during when particularly right after when Sharon Sandeen testified in December before the Senate Judiciary Committee, suddenly the argument about needing this because of cyber espionage went right out the window, and it went back to, well, we have to deal with rogue employees who are going to flee at the jurisdiction that the trade secret plaintiff is in, and therefore we need more rights to handle this. The fact is there was just a nearly $1 billion trade secret misappropriation judgment against an entity in Wisconsin. The Department of Justice has in its own manuals that are public, by the way, so not secret information, have shared examples of situations where a company claiming that a rogue employee is about to go out the out of the jurisdiction with trade secrets received a phone call from that company through the Department of Justice, and this individual was stopped at the airport. All of this is by way of saying that the proponents of the DTSA have not made the case that the DTSA is going to do anything more than existing robust state law to deal with the problems that they've identified. But because of the lack of real empirical understanding of trade secrecy, because by definition, trade secrets can't be shared, and if they are, they lose their value, right? We are flying blind. We're creating the most expansive new cause of action in intellectual property law in 30 years without any clear evidence that this is needed. But the downside risks are significant. The risk everywhere from empowering companies to keep even more information that isn't a trade secret from the public, to the ex parte seizure issues, to doctrines like the inevitable disclosure doctrine and others that have allowed state trade secret law to become more tailored. Again, the problem is that there's no real debate that there is a problem with cybersecurity. And nor is there a problem or any debate with regard to the fact that U.S. companies face significant risks of trade secret misappropriation. The real issue is, does the DTSA address those problems? And Sharon and Eric and Chris and many others who have signed our letters, and I know you posted one in the Google Doc for today, right, have said, show us the evidence that this is going to solve or even really address the issue. Having said that, you know, to the extent that people are concerned about these issues, like I said, there's been some writing, not a lot, on these issues. Jim Pooley has written an article in support of the DTSA. Sharon and Eric and Chris and I have written various pieces in opposition to it, so you can learn about it. But unfortunately, as it stands now, Congress looks like they're going to move this bill without having done nearly enough, I think, to really understand the complexities around trade secret law. And the risk is that this is a really big experiment that could have significant downsides. You posted, lastly, Denise, you posted a blog post. I saw it come up a couple of times. I sent to you that I wrote on whistleblowers. So there is a kernel of good news within the DTSA, which is that there's a very limited whistleblower exception in the DTSA when it was marked up and revised in the Senate that allows for individuals who are sharing trade secret information that is held by their employer with the government or in limited court actions to not suffer the consequences of being sued for trade secret misappropriation. This is certainly a positive step. However, it doesn't protect leakers. It doesn't protect sharing information, at least as it's written, with the press. It doesn't protect sharing information with the public. And there are some open questions with regard to whether an employer could, through contracts, write their way out of this provision. So it is, I want to be clear about it. I am happy that it's there. It doesn't address, I think, the broad endemic problems of how much information we label as secret that really doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be because of innovation theory. It doesn't have to be because of any evidentiary basis. But nonetheless, that is a positive thing. Having said that, my hope is that the DTSA is scrapped and that Congress really takes a much deeper look at trade secrecy and then returns perhaps to this issue in a way that is more thoughtful and frankly engages more stakeholders and more interests than just mostly the proponents of the DTSA.
Okay, thanks for that, Dave. Let's pivot a bit to something else that involves keeping things secret, except this time in an encrypted form. Let's talk for a moment about where things stand in the wake of the FBI versus Apple There is a piece of legislation pending in the Senate, the Burr-Feinstein encryption bill. That draft legislation has been released for discussion. And it seems to be directly in response to lawmakers' perceived problem that there is information that law enforcement might vitally need to get at that is locked up in an encrypted form on various devices, be they computers, phones, what have you. So this bill is designed to address that problem. It would require companies to decrypt their customer data upon receiving a court order. While FBI versus Apple was still pending, Michael, you were writing a bit and talking a bit about the First Amendment argument that Apple could have made there and may make as other law enforcement bodies attempt to get it to decrypt things. Do you think that that comes into play, the First Amendment concerns come into play as a reason to oppose this bill?
So the argument in the old Apple case was it was a form of compelled speech. Mm-hmm. And depending on what particular decryption method is at use in these cases, it may or may not. To the extent that it's just giving someone a key as opposed to actually, you know, assembling a team together, it may not, the key may not be a form of speech. As long as you don't have to sign it in some way.
The key to the key is you already have to have the key.
You have to have the key. So in some sense, it starts to feel more like an object than speech, right? I mean, the problem with software is it's always straddling the widget speech line. And a key is going to feel, I think, to a judge, more like a widget than a lot of things. But, you know, we don't have a lot of stuff in law which allows the government to just go and help themselves to your stuff because they need it for an investigation. We don't have nothing like that in our law. Right? There is some public safety stuff. Right? There's an epidemic, there's a fire. There are emergency powers the government has for those kinds of things. So I don't want to make it sound like there's an absolute rule here. But it's not an easy thing to do outside of the fire, the epidemic, public, you know, crisis kind of situation. So then we're going to get into, I think, takings law, for example. And we get into, you know, I don't know how well the law is going to be good at characterizing this, but the reality of the situation is if you're a manufacturer that's trying to build a trust relationship with your clientele, and the answer is that the government has a kind of a back door through your front door. Mm-hmm. That's not good for your relationship with your clients. So really it's being taken there as your goodwill, but now we're way beyond what normal takings law is competent to deal with. So I think, you know, it's very understandable why the people who build these products, maintain these products, run these services would be really nervous about this, just on the domestic side. And that doesn't even get you to the situation, foreign clients, right? I mean, you have a rule like this, goodbye to your foreign markets and a lot of things, because why would they want the U.S. government to have that kind of access to their stuff?
So and you've been following it. Have you been following it all? The other cases that are still pending. I think there's one in Brooklyn where the FBI is trying to get Apple to unlock other devices.
Well, let's start by saying the ones we know about are probably just the tip of the iceberg, right? If the data and the recent Microsoft filing is correct, there are hundreds of these things, of one kind or another, probably, you know, in terms of disclosure requirements, where the government wants them to go to the cloud. What makes the Apple case, iPhone case is special is it's handheld hardware rather than something sitting in the cloud. Mm-hmm. And those cases, as far as we know, are fewer in number. And they're still going. The one in Brooklyn is still going, as far as I know. None of these issues are going away. And I don't think anybody thinks the Feinstein bill resolves them in a way that makes any sense. It's not clear to me that the article you put up in your links, the one change, resolves them in a way that's going to make people, that's going to solve the problem, I think, people have with this politically and economically. It does solve the problem of, at least it's logical. Mm-hmm. It's no longer incoherent. That doesn't make it right, though. And again, I think here's if you're a firm that's trying to do, you know, have an export strategy, I don't think that one change is going to make the bill tenable from the point of view of their marketing plans.
This is a piece by Daniel Castro at The Hill, who says a common sense fix to the bill as it is now would be to only require companies to comply with lawful court orders when doing so is technically feasible. That seems like it would have a lot of wiggle room. It would have been technically feasible for Apple to assemble their team and sign their code. And
you can imagine a version where it says that they, you know, if it's feasible with just so much work, or if they have it, you know, on file or whatever. But even if it's easy, it's still not going to answer the fundamental economic issue for these companies, which is if it's known that this is what they do, foreign suppliers, especially foreign governments, are going to touch with a 10-foot pole. And domestically, it's not going to help either.
Dave, do you agree?
Yeah, you know, I pretty much agree with Mike on that. I was, you know, as I was, I had sent a note to Senator Tillis, one of two senators here in North Carolina, and it, just by pure coincidence, I got a response. It's a form response. It's not to me, but I think it's a response he gave everyone who wrote him. But there was one, a couple of sentences that jumped out, and this is an email I got at 12:39 p.m. Eastern Time today. He says that this issue is important and complex. We must work to ensure, this is a quote, that any legislation designed to address this issue strikes the right balance between consumer protections and public safety. Okay. But then it's the next sentence that really, I think, is where the rub is. We must vigilantly protect the privacy rights of our citizens and the trade secrets of American companies. And not to be a broken record, there's other things I've read about than trade secrecy. I'm not going to hijack it again and go back to DTSA. I want to say this. Those are the easiest situations that we could think about. Privacy rights of our citizens, whatever that means, trade secrets of American companies, right? Who's going to be in favor of Boeing's defense-related technology going to an enemy of the United States? But as Mike points out, the harder question is, what do we do in the grayer areas? I mean, you've pointed out with regard to that Hill article, Denise, you know, a perfect example of what, Mario Kaminsky has called legislative paraphrasing. Now, I know that that's not a legislative statement, to be clear, from the article. But the point is that unless you define terms very, very carefully, not only are you going to open up, you know, these kinds of situations to litigation, but worse, you could wind up having a very bad outcome. I mean, you know, most of the scholars and experts that, you know, I've read and talked to who focus on cryptography and encryption generally, generally agree that the last thing you want companies doing is writing code that creates backdoors. In terms of cybersecurity, you're much better off having companies and coders writing the best security that they can, and then having hackers write code to defeat it, than it is to have the entities that are trying to create robust cybersecurity writing the backdoors and the code itself. And that comes out of the FBI case. So generally, I agree. I pretty much agree with Mike.
Great. I know we're going to have to let you go in a little while, Dave, while we soldier on and complete the show. So I want to get to the TTIP and the TTP before we do let you go, because I know those are things you've been paying attention to. And that personally, I, in any event, have sort of known that they're still out there chugging away, but have sort of stopped paying close attention to. So if you could kind of bring me and our audience up to speed to the extent they need it as much as I do.
Sure. And, you know, I guess I really want to focus today more on anything else on acronyms. I thought it would be helpful to do acronyms today. So, yeah, so TTIP and TTP are two massive trade agreements. The TTIP is a bilateral negotiation between the United States and the EU, and the TPP is a multilateral agreement being negotiated amongst 13 countries, including the United States, Australia, Japan, a variety of large developed economies and some emerging economies. These agreements, and under the heading of why should This Week in Law listeners care, both of these agreements are
in all meaningful ways, by far the most expansive, quote unquote, trade agreements that the United States has been involved in. The TPP, and let's start there, the TPP's negotiations have been completed. The final text is now public, even though TPP was negotiated for several years in secret. The TPP includes traditional trade topics, but also includes other topics like e-commerce regulations and investor state dispute settlement procedures that allow for companies to bring legal actions within countries where they're doing business to challenge laws, to IP issues like the ability to prevent generic medicines that have elapsed in patent protection from being sold, to questions of linking to copyright, allegedly copyright infringing content on the internet. All of these issues are within the TPP. So there are enormous consequences for these agreements, far beyond traditional trade, because once a country has to or does ratify these agreements, they then have to conform their law to the agreement in TPP. The United States, being the big player on the block, has generally tried to export its version of IP law and technology law. And by the way, there's 20-odd other chapters, that many of which are not directly relevant to this listenership. But these countries would have to conform law. But basically, the United States is exporting its version of IP law, for example, to the countries that are signing. There has been some pushback. The biggest pushback is on an issue called that was negotiated, an issue called data exclusivity, which is an issue involving the ability of pharmaceutical companies to keep their research data secret and not public. And that was a bone of contention and seemingly the last issue that had to be hammered out. But as it stands now, in terms of status, the TPP is finalized. Congress is now in a review session, reviewing the agreement, but because of, and I recognize this is arcane stuff, the problem is it is arcane. However, it's extremely important because of the, and some of your listeners may recall this, because of the fast track battle that occurred last year, where Congress granted fast track authority to the president to negotiate. Congress is now unable to ultimately change the text of the TPP. Congress is now in a position and has put itself in a position to simply vote up or down on the TPP itself. So the time for changing the text of the TPP has elapsed. And that's a concern of mine as well, for reasons that I've talked about in the past and I won't get into here. So where it stands is, if Congress decides to ratify TPP, then, you know, then pretty much it would be coming to effect, at least for the United States. Again, the TPP has come up as a political issue in the presidential campaigns. Former Secretary Clinton was for and made statements in favor of the TPP while she was in the administration. She has since changed her position. Senator Sanders has been generally opposed to these agreements. And, you know, your guess is as good as mine about where the Republican Party stands on anything these days, except to say that Donald Trump has stated that he is opposed to TPP, and the other candidates have taken various positions. TTIP is in an earlier stage of negotiation. TTIP is an agreement that, again, we could spend, and we don't want to spend a tremendous amount of time going through the weeds, but TTIP basically has similar kinds of provisions that TPP does. But I say that by way of guesswork, because unlike TPP, which is now public, the text of TTIP is not. So we don't really know what is being said there. There's been a little more transparency, but ultimately it's a lot of guesswork. Of course, the EU is in a much stronger bargaining position vis-a-vis the United States than virtually all of the negotiating countries in TPP. So that negotiation continues. Next week in New York, another round of negotiations of TTIP, Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, will occur. The article that I sent to you for posting here points out that public support for TTIP in the United States and Germany is plummeting. And that's a very interesting development. I think we might speculate why it's plummeting here in the United States. And I think it's because presidential candidates, for the most part, have expressed some skepticism about it. The secrecy doesn't help, and really just general confusion around what's going on. But in Germany, there is a more interesting dynamic, which I think ties heavily, although not exclusively, to things like protests against the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement from a few years ago, where some of your listeners may remember people in Europe putting on Guy Fawkes masks and protesting ACTA, combined with, I think, the general challenges that the EU is facing right now in terms of the broad market economy, the fact that England is going to be voting on whether they're going to stay in the EU. And so I think trade itself is being broadly denigrated in a lot of advanced economies. The interesting part is, again, these are trade agreements. Why are we talking about them here? We're talking about them here because these provisions are regulating e-commerce, they're regulating the internet, they're regulating information access, they're regulating access to medicine, and they're called trade agreements. And that, I think, is the biggest problem of all, that I think most people are not simply aware that these issues really are affecting them and could, beyond their traditional concerns about trade, like, will I have a job? So that's the status right. update. And again, I apologize for having to leave early today, but Passover is pushing me in that direction.
Yes, and we're going to get you out of here. There are two things that I want to get in the show before we excuse you, Dave. One has to do with Sean Parker's streaming service, The Screening Room, that was announced recently, which is upheaving the film and particularly the theater industry. What it stands to be when it comes to market is a box that you pay $150 for to have in your home that is going to have first released movies. That it's going to eliminate the windowing that we're all familiar with, where you have to go to the theater to see certain movies. It would make it much more like the hotel situation, where you go to and stay at a hotel and you're surprised because there on the hotel pay-per-view, you have movies that are still in theaters. I think it would be more, you know, the arrangements they're doing are more like that. I'm sure it's even better than that, in that you're going to be getting things, I think, if Sean Parker gets his way and gets all his contracts and licenses in order, you're going to be getting things same day as theater release. That obviously is making theater owners unhappy and Hollywood much upheaved. And I'm just wondering, you know, before we let you go, Dave, I'd love to get your take on that disruptive technology that's headed our way.
So I'm going to quote our friend Eric Goldman on this one too. I've now mentioned him twice. By the way, I'm not getting paid by any of these people I've mentioned to mention their names. That would be a lucrative business model for me, but I'm just doing it. You know, Eric, you know, has said in the past that he finds it amusing when the entertainment industry fights against things that consumers actually want. And I think that's kind of my jumping off point here. Now, clearly, right, there are divergent interests here between what content producers may want to do and what theater owners want, right? And so there's a couple of issues here that I'd want to flag. First is almost experiential, right? The question being, right, how much of movie going involves the experience of going into a theater, right, buying popcorn and having that experience versus merely, right, consuming the content. Now, you know, what we've already seen, right? I mean, you know, if you get an Apple TV or Roku, right, iTunes, for example, right, does have some limited offerings of movies that are actually in theaters. And so the question becomes, how much of that is going to draw against the market that already exists in theaters? You know, I think it's a safe assumption to say that theaters are not going to benefit from this, the theaters themselves not going to benefit from this product. How much the damage is going to be, again, you know, this is the second kind of big issue that I would flag here, and there are others, which is the general lack, and I alluded to already, but the lack of really good evidence about what the actual harms are associated with infringement. Copyright infringement is one of those areas which, and this is a, not a new issue, where naturally you're going to have content creators make claims that every possible use which is not authorized or not allegedly authorized takes money out of the pocket of industry, right? And query whether, you know, you taking iTunes, for example, query whether an individual in a country where 99 cents for a song or the comparable price is simply unaffordable is actually creating harm to content producers when they steal if they weren't going to buy in the first place. That's not, again, to say that stealing's okay or that copyright infringement's okay, but the question is what the harms are. And the reason why I mention it here is that, you know, to the extent that we have good information, there's no question that the movie industry is now generally suffering more in terms of straight up infringement or piracy than other content industries have been. And so if the film industry is getting hit more heavily now by piracy or infringement, choose your term, then I think taking a hard look at alternative revenue streams makes a lot of sense. I hope that industry doesn't treat this situation like they attempted to treat the Sony Betamax, right, where they attempted to sue, and I say they, but, you know, representatives of the industry attempted to sue the Betamax out of existence, leading to a very well-known and very important and influential Supreme Court decision that found that using a VCR, using the Betamax, was not copyright infringement because it was what the court called time shifting. In other words, you're recording it for watching later. Ultimately, of course, we now know that those kinds of technologies have been an enormous boon. The industry will see that as well.
Yep. All right, we're going to stay on this topic after we let you go, Dave. I want to get Mike and Michael's takes on this as well. But sure. Before we let you go, I just want to give a big plug to the fact that next week on April 26th, you get to interview Larry Lessig.
Yes.
At your law school, at Elon Law School in Greensboro, North Carolina, at 12:30 p.m. on April 26th. Very exciting. Is that going to be available for the rest of us who can't make it there to join you?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for bringing this up, Denise. And thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure meeting you, Mike and Mike, who I look forward to chatting with in the future as well. The show is going to be recorded live for airing on KZSU in the beginning of May. Shockingly, and I am shocked by this, this is the 10th anniversary of Hearsay Culture. I've been doing this show now coming into May for 10 years. And so... Yeah, it's amazing. And I know, and you know, Denise, as you know, you kindly interviewed me at the suggestion of some listeners for show number 200. So I'm very excited about this. So the answer is yes, the show will be available. It's going to air on May 3rd on KZSU. So you can go to kzsulive.stanford.edu, and then it will become a podcast along with all the other podcasts that I've done. But I'm very grateful for Larry taking the time, given the work that he is doing now, focusing on campaign finance reform, taking the time to come to Elon and sit down for one of my long form interviews. But it will be available to the public. Of course, anyone who is near Greensboro, North Carolina, it is a public event, and anyone is welcome. And I hope to see as many folks as possible there physically.
Great. Wonderful. Congratulations on 10 years of Hearsay Culture. Good luck with the interview. And we'll see you back, I hope, soon on This Week in Law.
I look forward to it. Thanks, everyone. And again, apologies for having to leave a little early. This has been a lot of fun.
No worries. Happy Passover.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks, Dave.
Hey, daylight comes a lot later down here.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Well, I'm going to go have some rice now, too. So that's an inside Jewish law joke, which I'll leave for another time. Take care.
Take care.
See ya.
All right, so let's stay on the screening room for a moment. I guess we'll put our second MCLE passphrase into the show and make it what consumers want, because that seems to be what this is. I know that it sounds like a great idea, and depending on how the pricing pencils out, I'd certainly at least consider having one in the House. What do you think, Michael?
Well, I'm the wrong guy to ask because I have a completely different way of consuming this stuff. I mean, I have actually a projector at home, but we get almost all our movies from the library. So, you know, after the we don't watch them when they come out mostly. And there's this wonderful thing called the Wowbury, which tells you about when movies, when new acquisitions are coming to the library. It's on my RSS feed. So every time they announce they're going to buy a new DVD that I'm interested in, I quickly, you know, run over to the site, get myself in the queue. You know, if I'm lucky, I'm at the beginning of the queue. If I'm not lucky, I'm 110th in the queue, and it takes a few extra weeks. But because, you know, I'm just living in an academic bubble, but it doesn't really matter to me when when I see the movie. Whether I see the movie. And there's plenty in the pipeline to keep me busy. So, in fact, I'm behind. I can't keep up as it is. They're making a lot of movies, you know, I want to see, or TV shows or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm the wrong guy to ask because I'm not going to the movie. I can't remember the last time I was in a movie theater, except that there were a lot of people talking really loud just behind me.
Yes, the movie experience is questionably pleasant for everyone involved, and theaters are trying so hard to combat that. One thing I just saw fly across my RSS feed were moves by some theaters to make attending movies in theater more attractive to young people by dispensing with the rule that you can't use your phone during a movie.
They had to withdraw that. There was so much protest.
Was there really?
Yeah, that was on my feed. So was the tail between the legs announcement. Nope, we give up. We're not going to do it.
Oh, because, you know, I certainly think that my son and his cadre of friends would be more likely to go to a movie if they knew they weren't going to have to shut down their phones.
So Miami, people are doing it anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, I mean, I think there'll be demand for this if it's priced right from people who care a lot about seeing a movie the week it comes out, because that's something they talk about with their friends.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you want to be part of the community that's talking about a film, this might be attractive to people. But that isn't, you know, we don't have a water cooler, and I'm not standing over and talking about movies.
Well, you raise a really interesting point, and I'm curious to get your take too, Mike. That the windowing that has been ongoing for so long has trained us to wait for movies until they're accessible in a way that we want to consume them. And so it's developed this patience and this, you know,
The wait got shorter for a lot of films.
Yeah, the waiting is shorter.
You know, if it was 2 years, we might not be so patient.
Right. Right, but I feel like at this point, you know, I was happy to see Star Wars The Force Awakens come out on demand and on DVD recently, and I watched it again, of course, when it did that. But I did go see it in the theater. That kind of movie will get me into a theater.
See that at the theater. It did, yes. Yeah,
very few, few will.
If Denise, you can get tickets to Star Wars, right? So I was just going to say before you mentioned that, you know, I hope to have the screening room myself before the next Star Wars films comes out. So I understand you also get 2 free tickets to any film that you actually purchase, or at least that's one of the potential business models they're considering. So that would be an interesting twist as well.
Yes, that would help them. Well, I'm sure they're free to you, but not free to the theaters. I'm sure they're going to do some sort of arrangement that would make that appealing.
You get it? Do you get to see it more than once, or are you only going to get one play in the system, you know?
Ooh, I do not know. I'm guessing it would be one play.
Are you owning it? What's the, you know, you're licensing it for one view or six or?
I think it said something about how you have a 48-hour window and you have to watch it within that 48-hour window, and it also includes this free ticket issue, so.
Yeah,
but I don't know if you get multiple plays or if it's just one.
It's funny how copyright panic hits people. So we had one of the colleges here in the university, the master of the college, decided to show some movies he was getting from the library or renting from Blockbuster back then to undergraduates on movie night. And the general counsel put a stop to it. It was afraid it would be seen as something theatrical, even though they weren't charging admission. And the general counsel just got all panicky and said, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, that is sad. Well, I think it's a fascinating development. Sean Parker, once again, doing something that disrupts a business and may have legal overtones. We'll just have to see what happens there. There's a really fascinating piece in Vanity Fair, and everything we've alluded to that we've read in advance of the show is available and aggregated for you to read at your leisure. If you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, the tag there is our episode number 343. If you want all of the things that we've aggregated for the show today. And this was a report from the Theater Owners Convention in Las Vegas. It's the convention that the studios and the theater owners get together, and the studios are supposed to be getting the theaters excited about their upcoming offerings. I guess this was sort of so much the thing that no one wanted to mention but was alluded to all week. The author says the enterprise, that being the screening room, was alluded to so much all week that one attendee observed, "It's almost like the screening room was Voldemort, he who must not be named. I was almost happy when James Cameron on the final day of the presentations came out and attacked screening room by name." So I guess it's been taking some hits there at that convention. As you can imagine, theater owners not too thrilled about this. But the other fascinating tidbit from that article is just how much money is made on popcorn, which costs about 15 cents a serving to prepare. Let's move on. Michael, you sent a New York Times story my way that we went back and forth about before the show as to whether we were going to talk about. It's a privacy related story actually involving fashion. So let's talk about that.
So this is really my excuse to talk about something else in a way, which is the fashion there is about these burqas, these fashionable burqas, and the question, really interesting question, the extent to which people, quote unquote, giving in to the religious demands of some consumers or some elements in society or in international society, you know, might be doing something wrong by making burqas look good. And by, you know, catering into the idea that women's bodies ought to be camouflaged or hidden in certain ways. But what really struck, and that's a very important issue and one that I actually do think about because I'm trying to decide if I want to start writing more about the regulation of identification, the regulation of identity. But there is another piece to this, which I think people aren't really aware of. And that is that cameras now are being deployed so much in public that all of us now are being recorded for large parts of our lives in urban areas. It's especially true in London, but it's also increasingly true in the United States. Facial recognition is getting really good. I mean, we're not quite at the point yet where it's seamless, but we're at a point where we can foresee that it's going to be seamless. And then the question is, how much of yourself do you have to cover up so that the camera can't track you around the city? And one of the things they track you by is ear shape sometimes. Sometimes it's the relationship of the eyes to the rest of the face. Sometimes it's your gait, in which case this clothing isn't going to help at all because how you walk. But it does kind of raise the question. I mean, I said at the time I was sort of joking that the masks mm-hmm. would be the fashion accessory of the mid-21st century. And I don't think it's a joke anymore.
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
That's why I was interested in the piece. I mean, although I think don't want in any way downplay the importance of the cultural questions that are being raised there too, which I think are fascinating. I mean, to what extent is wearing a covering or even a disguise liberating, or if someone's making you do it or encouraging you to do it, the opposite of liberating?
Right.
But it may be someday for all of us, freedom looks not just like that, but like that with a mask on top.
Right. Or I was almost thinking of this from the flip side of that perspective. If you know, big fashion is getting into making more Muslim-inspired fashion and marketing it more and putting it out there, is that actually harmful to you from a surveillance standpoint? You raised the point that you can use these fashions to hide some things that can be identified, but it's the fashion itself that may be a trigger. Well,
it's like encryption used to. If you're the only person who uses encryption, mm-hmm. you stood out of the pile. Mm-hmm. Right now we've got Let's Encrypt and they're putting it on everything. You don't stand out as much. And it's going to be the same thing with clothing. Obviously, if you're the only person wearing, you know, crazy face paint in order to defeat facial recognition, you stick out like a sore thumb. If everybody's doing it, you don't.
Right. And I think of the musical artist Sia in this context, too, and how I guess if you've been following her for a long time or you're good at internet sleuthing, you might know what she looks like. But most people don't. And that's obviously intentional. It's part of her brand. It's part of her image. But maybe it's part of her image because of her desire not to be.
She doesn't look like a little kid in the video.
Sorry?
She doesn't look like that little kid in the video. I'm kidding.
No, she doesn't look like the little kid. but possibly, you know, I don't know that much about her, but I suspect that some of her reasoning has to do with, hey, you know, I want to be able to go to the grocery store. I want to be able to walk around when I'm not wearing my bangs in front of my eyes and nose look and not have people know that I'm Sia. Mike, do you have any thoughts on the implications of Muslim-inspired fashion?
Boy, I don't think I do.
It is a bit of a hot potato. And I was telling Michael that if we're going to talk about this on the show, they better have, you know, wearables built into it so that it ties in with what we generally discuss. But I do think it's, you know, if this does spread in the way that this New York Times piece is suggesting that it already is and has, that
another trend, which is countermeasure clothing.
Right. Well, countermeasure clothing, but then does it also lead to just more profiling? And I suppose that's what you were saying. When everyone's using encryption, if you can't really profile on that anymore.
Right.
All righty. Let us move on to, well, we had a couple of legislative developments that we didn't get to. Michael, do you want to weigh in at all about Microsoft's suit against the Justice Department about the gag orders? I know you alluded to that earlier, been eye-opening.
I mean, they have a great moral case, mm-hmm. and they have a great sort of practical case, right? I mean, Microsoft right now, for people who have been following this, every time they get one of these gag orders, the gag order can either be for a limited time or under the statute can be forever. And so if Microsoft wants to challenge the forever part and after some period of time say, we have a right to tell the public what the government is making us do so that people can understand the public policy consequences of how the government is taking advantage of certain technological architectures. They have to go back into court. They got to pay a lawyer. They got to make a case. It's not that easy, and it's expensive. So they're trying to bring a general suit claiming that the whole thing is unconstitutional, either because the gag order interferes with their First Amendment right or because the Fourth Amendment right of their customers are being affected. Now, it's very tough to assert somebody else's Fourth Amendment right. So that's their first problem. Mm-hmm. The second problem they're going to have, I mean, I think they're absolutely right that the way the statute is constructed right now goes completely against how people feel about their information. They think it's their information. And you don't think if you're putting it on Dropbox, that therefore because it's copied in the cloud, it's not yours anymore, and therefore the government can look at it with one of these orders. But that is the legal reality. So Microsoft's got a lot of good points here, and I think it's great that they're bringing this case, even if to some extent they've been forced into it by the expense of fighting them one at a time, which they wouldn't have to do, but they care enough to do. So that's a really good thing. I mean, it's weird. I find myself praising Microsoft more and more in the past years. And it still feels strange, but they're actually becoming a privacy company. So congratulations to Brad Smith and the rest of the team there. The legal problem that they are going to have, this was originally pointed out by another blogger, is that there's a big push in the constitutional law for these kinds of cases to force parties to do them as applied rather than facially. So to do them one by one based on facts, which is exactly the problem they're trying to get over here. But there is some doctrine. I mean, the Rehnquist Court in particular was really against facial challenges on constitutional grounds and wanted them to be as applied. So they're going to be slightly arguing uphill here. Now, as I think Microsoft itself said in one of its announcements, the strategy here isn't simply judicial. It's also to inform the debate over things like the reauthorization of ECPA and the amendments of ECPA. So it's also partly a legislative strategy as well. And I'm hopeful something will come of it because, again, I think what they're trying to do is realign the legal reality with how people feel about the technology. You're holding your cell phone. You don't realize that everything that's interesting about that cell phone's in the cloud somewhere. Mm-hmm. and therefore subject to these court orders that you wouldn't imagine.
Right. I think the FBI versus Apple dispute and the public nature of it opened a lot of people's eyes on that front. You know, as to how we...
I've never heard anyone mention before, so let me give it to you.
Sure.
An awful lot of these companies use one of three or four backends, like Amazon, to provide their services because it's so much cheaper and more efficient. So you spin it up, an instance on Amazon, say. Well, now, unless you've encrypted everything in a way that Amazon doesn't have, they've got access to it too. So the government, we don't know how much the government is going to Amazon or will be going to Amazon to get orders to get all these things. The point is there's two points of failure here. There's the company you deal with that has your data, and there's the host that it's contracting with.
Right. Yeah, excellent point. So many ways to get at the data. The other thing you wanted to talk about before we get out of here, Michael, is antitrust and what's going on as far as the EU and Google and between Microsoft and Google. Can you let us know about that?
I think this is huge. I really think the EU piece is particularly, the Microsoft piece is just weird, but the EU piece is huge. What's happened here is that the EU has started the process to basically indict Google for taking a unfair advantage of its dominant position on the Android system. I have an Android phone, and it's absolutely the case that on my phone, the Google apps have pride of place. And apparently this is true throughout the Android architecture. So they're basically bringing a case a lot like the one they brought against Microsoft a few years ago about the pride of place for Explorer on Windows operating systems, which led to a settlement, right? The EU basically won that case. And as far as I can tell from, you know, the 5,000 foot level on the raid, this is the same case with very similar facts. So that has to be a real worry for Google about Android. Now, I think coincidentally, at least they claim coincidentally, the very same week this drops, we get this news that Microsoft and Google have reached an agreement to stop bringing regulatory claims against each other. Now, they claim in the news articles that have been published that this is something they've been negotiating for a long time. It's just coincidental. Okay. But it's kind of interesting because, I mean, one of the groups that have been complaining about this sort of behavior was Microsoft.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not going to stop the EU case, but it may make bringing other cases like this in the future a bit tougher. I mean, the EU just has much tougher antitrust law right now than we do, and a much more aggressive competition regulator than we do, which I think is a great loss for us, actually, because as you may have guessed from some things I said earlier, I think we need to rely on the market to do a lot of disciplining of behavior in ways that we can't really turn to the government to do, or we shouldn't have to turn to the government to do. It's the second best by far for some kinds of regulation. But if our markets are such that we just have one major dominant player, then that competitive check on the corporations isn't happening. And that's where antitrust has to step in. Whatever you think of antitrust law, whatever you think of Microsoft and Google, I think it's very easy to see the parallels here. And just as the case against Microsoft resulted in some substantial changes in how Windows was sold and packaged in Europe, this could result in some big changes for Android.
All right. Well, we will continue to monitor that. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. We do, before we get out of here, have a tip and a resource for you. And we also have an animal selfie of the week. We've been featuring animal selfies when we could find them for a while. They were coming fast and furious. I'm afraid the one that I've cobbled together for us this week, and the reason that we talk about them is because of the fun copyright ramifications of an animal as photographer, be they a monkey or a dog or a cat or an octopus. Here we have someone who has set up a dog to be his own photographer. I'll let you guys decide if you think that that's what's really going on here. Name of the video is If Dogs Could Snapchat.
Yeah.
No makeup.
Okay. All right. We'll go. Stop. Give me a second. Let me just check my Facebook. All right. Okay. We're going to go. All right. Stop it.
The cute little Pomeranian is definitely the star of the video. I have trouble thinking that the dog actually Snapchatted all this, typed in the text, etc. But it's a cute little creative effort and our animal selfie of the week. Our tip of the week involves another video that we'll play for you. The tip, let's play the video first and then we'll see if you can discern what the tip is.
So I invited a few of the world's best hackers to try to hack me and show me where my vulnerabilities are. And now I'm going to meet them in Las Vegas for DEF CON, the biggest hacker convention of the year. They're going to hack me using social engineering, which is essentially hacking without any code. They just use a phone and an internet connection.
Do you want to do a sample phishing call?
What's phishing?
Phishing is voice solicitation. And basically what you do is you use the phone to extract information or data points that can be used in a later attack.
Let's do it. Who are you going to call?
Maybe I'll call your cell phone provider and see if I can get them to give me your email address.
I bet they're good. I bet they have my back. But yeah, go for it.
I'm going to spoof from your number, so it's going to look like it's calling from you.
Okay.
Hi, I'm so sorry. Can you hear me okay? I'm sorry. My husband's like, we're about to apply for a loan and we just had a baby and he's like, get this done by today. So I'm so sorry. I can't call you back. I'm trying to log into our account for uses information and I can't remember what email address we used to log the account. The baby's crying and can you help me? Awesome.
In just 30 seconds,
@gmail.com.
Jessica gets access to my personal email address.
So basically, getting back to our tip here, Jessica goes on and gets all kinds of information about this gentleman's accounts. He is Kevin Roos at Fusion. This is in part episode 8 of Real Future over at Fusion. And the tip here involves being fooled by crying babies and barking dogs, because obviously all she's doing is queuing up a little WAV file or otherwise online a false crying baby in the background. And I can tell you, as a woman who's had to make customer service calls in real crying baby and barking dog situations, that it does actually help, that people do get sympathetic and want to help you on your way when they feel like you're in the middle of all the chaos that they can hear around you. So just beware of those. Possibly our lawmakers should think about, and this is where my sarcasm is kicking in, I hope nobody takes this seriously, that perhaps we need to outlaw all the crying baby and barking dog sounds that are available for free and nefarious use.
Oh, hold on. The takeaway here is, if I want to get better customer service, I need a wave of a crying baby.
That's right. It really does help. So yes, you're right. You can take that tip however you'd like it. Either use it or beware of it. But the power of the crying baby, I guess, is the takeaway. And our resource of the week comes all the way back to the WeRobot conference that just happened and all of the various sessions that are available on video at its site. So if you missed the conference, definitely take advantage of the fact that the sessions are available, and take advantage of the fact that Professor Frumkin and Ryan Kahlo and others have edited together a book on robot law that has just been published. Can you tell us a bit about that, Michael?
So the book is almost entirely composed of papers from the first few conferences. They've just been polished up a bit since then. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting for us to sort of put a marker to the world that this is a serious subject of its own, with sort of common terminology and a set of concerns, and is also really interdisciplinary. That to do it right, I mean, I think one of the things that all the editors agreed is, to do this right, you have to work in teams, you have to have people who are either, if not in teams, have multiple qualifications, And if you're working on your own, you really have to pay very careful attention to what, if you're a lawyer, what the engineers are telling you, or vice versa. And the human factors people, the anthropologists, the military, we have them all in here. Now, if you're one of the people who thinks that the dead tree version of something is just too old to be useful, I think we might prove you wrong. But if we can't convince you, I do want to point out that the early versions of all the papers that are presented in those videos are also available from our website. So you can get the book for the older, polished version of the older ones and get the rawer, newer draft versions of the newer one. And between them, there's a real wide spectrum of views on a lot of issues that are going to become real in the next 5 to 10 years. One of the things that I'm really proud of at these conferences is we have been ahead of the curve.
That's so fantastic. And for anyone who's interested in this field, watching the sessions of the conference that just happened, getting the book and following along with Michael Frumkin is an excellent thing to do. We're so glad that you've taken the time to join us today on the show, Professor Frumkin.
Oh, this is amazing. You go into so much more depth than most of the things that I get called on to do. It's really impressive.
Thank you so much. And we're happy to do it. It's what we love to do. And we couldn't do it if you couldn't join us. So we're just so thrilled that you did. Aside from the book, is there anything else that you want to let folks know about before we go ahead and say goodbye?
Well, if I get to do promo, I will promo one other thing I do. I run an online law journal called Jotwell for the Journal of Things We Like Lots at jotwell.com. Mm-hmm. And this is where we force law professors to say nice things. So we have 300 of the top law professors from around the world who write for us each once a year about the most interesting recent piece of scholarship they run into in their field, not by themselves. And believe it or not, that last one takes law enforcement. So 5 days a week, we're publishing stuff from different areas of the law. And it's kind of like a New York Review of Books for people interested in law. And we're trying to write in a style that will be accessible even to non-lawyers. But in particular, for lawyers who want to know what's happening in fields other than their own, this is a way to find out. And I created this because I wanted to read it. And I love reading it. Because I don't have time to read all the articles in areas outside my field. And it's really interesting to know what's going on.
Oh, that is so fantastic. I did not know about this. I, too, will be reading it. What a great idea and a great illustration that some of the best things that are created in the world are when someone wants something and it doesn't exist.
Each where. You got it.
Yep. Mike Keyes, it's been so great chatting with you today. Thank you so much for making the time.
Denise, as always, thank you. It was terrific. And we really appreciate Professor Frumkin and Professor Levine being with us. That was just terrific. Thanks so much.
So great. And we brought our show into a landing at just about 2 hours here. So we've packed it all in. If you've joined us live as we recorded the show, that means you tuned in at 11 o'clock Pacific time on a Friday. That's when we record the shows each week. We will be dark next week, but we'll be back the week after that if you want to plan ahead. If you can't join us live, don't worry. You can find the archived shows at twit.tv/twill, going all the way back to the beginning. So it's really fun to root around in the archives, find your favorite guests, find topics that you'd forgotten all about were a big deal, and try and see what has happened to those topics since that time. We've been doing the show like Hearsay Culture, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. This Week in Law will as well in October as opposed to May. So we've been around for a bit and there's lots there to rummage through and enjoy. You can listen to the show on your computer, on your TV. Various ways of subscribing to the show are there on the twit.tv/twill page so that it is available for you if you just want to do the audio on a treadmill, however you'd like to listen to or watch the show. It's there for you to fit it into your life. And we're very happy that you do that. You can get in touch with us between the shows. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Our other co-host, Emery Roan, is not with us this week, but he is, guess what? Emery at twit.tv. So let us know what you're thinking, guests you think we should invite on. Find us on our Facebook page for This Week in Law or our Google Plus page or community for This Week in Law. All great ways to let us know what's on your mind, what you thought jokes you think we might appreciate, whatever is on your mind, we'd love to hear from you. I'm on Twitter as well, and that is a great way to get in touch. D. Howell there. J. Michael Keyes is Mike Keyes there. We love hearing from you. Thank you so much for letting us know what's on your mind and for tuning in each week for This Week in Law. Take care.